hasn't been that until.
Okay, we're we do not have a quorum, but we're going to start the testimony on the budget proposals from the Department of Health, and we're just going to today have a comment from the general public or anybody else that wants to talk about the Department of Health budget. So with that, and as soon as we have a quorum, we'll move the minutes and call the meeting officially to order, but we're going to start the testimony, and we're going to start out with Roger Bingston. If he's here.
I can see your feeler. I look at it.
Yeah. And if you could keep your testimony to less than 5 minutes, we'd appreciate it. And could you give your name for the tape?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Roger Bankson, and I am the president of the Minnesota Funeral Directors Association. MFDA is in its 123rd year as an association that represents members of funeral homes all across the state. We're here today to testify on two mortuary science changes contained in the Department of Health's budget. The first is regarding alkaline hydrolysis, and as you've heard, alkaline hydrolysis is a newer form of disposition that has been used at the Mayo Anatomical Department and the University of Minnesota Veterinarian School for a number of years. This past year, the first funeral home in Minnesota was licensed to use this form of disposition, and we expect this to become more widely used here in Minnesota. The Department of Health convened a working group over the past several months, which we were very appreciative to be a part of. All of the stakeholder groups were well represented, and we feel that the group came up with a very good policy framework. We are supportive of the department's efforts and look forward to continuing to work with them as this legislation moves forward in the process. The second change is more concerning to us. It involves removing the current requirement that all funeral homes have a prep room. We have yet to see any details, but we believe prep rooms are an important part of all funeral homes and have been required by the health department in all buildings licensed by them to be a funeral home, regardless of their proximity to any other location. The preparation room is not only used for embalming, but it's a private area in the funeral home where remains are prepared for cremation and are held while waiting for the authorizations needed by the physicians and the medical examiners or coroners prior to the cremation or the alkaline hydrolysis to be completed. We understand there may be some funeral homes supporting this change, but the majority of the MFDA members have many questions and would like to engage the department in further discussions about concerns regarding the health and the safety and the impact this may have on the communities we serve. We also understand that the department is currently involved in litigation regarding this issue, and we feel it is more appropriate that that be resolved before the legislature make any changes. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? I don't see anything, and I've been told thank you very much.
Thank you.
That we have a quorum, so I will call the meeting to order, and the minutes, and Representative Schumacher, I see they've spelled your name correctly.
I've seen that too, Chair.
Would you like to move the minutes?
As accurate as they are, Mr. Chair, yes, I'd like to move them.
Okay, any discussion of the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Minutes are approved, and now we'll continue with the today's testimony. And next we have Bonnie Bruschoff, Local Public Health Association from Dakota County.
Yes. Yes, good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for this opportunity to testify today. I am Bonnie Bruschoff, and I'm the Public Health Director at Dakota County. And I'm also the legislative co-chair for the Local Public Health Association, and that's who I'm here representing today on behalf of the city, the county, and the tribal public health departments throughout the state. So as MDH stressed, well, the majority of factors that influence health can be addressed through prevention. There's only a small portion of healthcare expenditures that go towards those preventive measures. LPHA is very pleased that in Governor Dayton's budget, there's recognition of the investment to prioritize looking at upstream preventative measures on health and human services. LPHA strongly supports the governor's recommendation to fund the nation-leading statewide health improvement program at $40 million over the next biennium. I've distributed some handouts, and there was a press release issued by the SHIP Coalition included in that packet, and that's a broad-based group of public health officials, physicians, health plans, and other advocacy organizations, praising again the governor's decision to fund SHIP at levels that might once again allow it to reach all corners of the state. I know you have already heard a lot about SHIP, and I refer you to our fact sheet that was also in that packet from local public health and the SHIP Coalition, as well as there is a lot of information I know included in the MDH budget narrative. What I will stress is just from my county's perspective and my community what SHIP looks like. And SHIP was, and to some degree, still doing great things in Dakota County. I've distributed a third document that is that talks about the progress in improving the community's health pre- and post-SHIP funding. And you'll see that as far as what was outlined, what happened in Dakota County during SHIP. The bottom line is after a few short years to get the programs up and running in our county, most of the SHIP activities had to be reduced or discontinued with the loss of SHIP funds. We were making great progress on impacting health, helping people quit smoking, lose weight, and have healthy food choices. And overall, those things have been stalled. All nine public school districts in Dakota County made changes to increase our healthy food choices, and that reach was to about 70,000 students, and that was because of SHIP. There are a total of 51 schools that increased physical activity, and these changes remain in part in place due to SHIP leveraging other funds, such as grants that we've received from Blue Cross Blue Shield and the UCARE, which I'll give an example here shortly. Thanks to SHIP, the college campuses and businesses in Dakota County went tobacco-free and workplaces acquired healthy foods, but the loss of SHIP funding has curtailed those successes and kept the program from reaching more students and more employees. Not only did Dakota County make countless impactful health policy improvements like offering nutritious food options in schools, but partnerships and the funding opportunities were leveraged to strengthen the community. So, for example, with SHIP, we built strong relationships with our schools and showed that we had effective partnerships. This enabled us to leverage funding by receiving a competitive UCARE grant just this past year. We have two physical education teachers who are champions of SHIP from Farmington, and they work to develop an innovative literacy physical education program, which focuses on increasing physical activity, and they found that it improves test scores in the school. So in knowing this, we partnered with them, and recently we've held a presentation to all 18 elementary school principals in District 196 in our county, and that's the schools where they have in the area of Rosemont, Apple Valley, and Egan. And they had time with those teachers then to demonstrate that this program and talk about the connection between physical activity, health, and learning, and then to offer resources that we have because of now having a UCARE grant. We have one school, Cedar Park, that will be a pilot, and that's an elementary school in 196, to now take this program on and be able to look at what they can do with their reading and physical activity in that school. The students are excited because, of course, they love to read and run and move. And the teachers are excited because, based on the past experience in Farmington, we know that they get results. And again, it has proven to show that it improves their test scores in reading. This school in particular is of interest to us, and we're glad they're going to be doing the program because there's a high percentage of low-income and minority students who are at risk for both obesity and academic failure. So thanks to the foundation that we had with SHIP and also the ability then to have some UCARE funding to focus on a program such as I just mentioned. The governor understands that, as was the case in Dakota County, without sufficient and stable funding, SHIP can no longer catalyze these and similar efforts in all parts of the state. In addition to SHIP, As far as what was in the MDH budget, LPH is glad to see the allocation for sustained technical assistance to local health departments in the governor's budget, and that partially offsets federal cuts to the preventive block grant. We're also happy to see healthy homes allocation, and that partially offsets federal cuts to lead surveillance. LPHA is pleased to see that Governor Dayton proposes increasing the price of tobacco to prevent youth from smoking, help current smokers quit, and reduce health care costs for all Minnesotans. So in conclusion, we know that Minnesota now sits at 48th in the nation in state funding for public health. This is far too low for a state that has such a rich history of strong health care and health care delivery. Public health and prevention need to be a larger part of that moving forward if we expect to curb costs and keep Minnesotans healthy through their life. We are pleased that the governor sees this need and has begun to make certain key public health infrastructure investments like SHIP are a priority. So thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and you can take questions if there's any.
Representative Fritz.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your presentation. But I also want to thank the representative sitting to my right, Representative Loeffler, who actually, that was her bill. In 2007, I believe you had a study, and then in 2008, this became law. And I thank all of you, both of you, and all of you for having this program, because in my county, Rice County, I believe we received about $50,000 the first time around. And I saw and continue to see the live, work, learn, and playing of all ages, my age all the way down to young people, walking, running, riding bikes, outdoors. People have outdoor activities, and this has been huge. And also, one of our community leaders who's retired, James Wolfe, often has an editorial in a Faber Daily News talking about what's going on, and people read that. It's a very well-read publication, and I think that's a thing to do, is not only can we see these people out being active and needing and using the activities, a small amount of money that I got in my nursing home, we did stretching exercises before and after our shifts, brought down our workers' comp way down. So it's been a very worthwhile program. Thank you for that.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Okay, thank you.
And next we have Jonathan Watson, Community Health Centers.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Watson. I'm the Director of Public Policy with the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. We represent the 17 federally qualified health centers in the state that serve roughly 185,000 low-income individuals. They're located in the inner cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul and in the rural areas of our state. However, we do have a big service area in a sense that we serve nearly 50% of the state's zip codes. So people do drive a long ways to access care at a community health center. 40% of our patients are uninsured. We care for one out of every six uninsured Minnesotans, providing the primary care, medical, behavioral health, and dental services. So today I want to talk about two items that are related to the governor's budget. First being the community health center appropriation from the Minnesota Department of Health, and secondly, the quality measurement effort currently underway in terms of health care outcomes. So starting with the community health center appropriation, the FQHCs in the state received these funds to, quote, continue to expand and improve services to low-income populations. That's from the statute. The appropriation stands right now at $2.3 million and it was established in 2006. They use these funds, the community health centers, for a large areas of their operations. First and foremost is partially offsetting the cost of providing care to the uninsured, which was about $40 million in 2012. They also use the funds to redesign their practices to become healthcare homes in terms of some of the investments they need to make strategically. They make investments into healthcare, health information technology. Care coordination is going to become vital for community health centers and their patients, so we need to invest into our information technology system so we can communicate with other providers. Also, the last two is we do provide or invest in a lot of dental services. The demand for dental services at community health centers is overwhelming at times, and so we do invest some of these funds into staff and equipment for dental services. These are all upstream investments, and our hope, the community health center model, is to really have those avoidable ER visits and hospitalizations. So that is a lot of what those dollars go for. After 2014, after reform is implemented, we are ramping up for an increase in patients. Actually, the experience in Massachusetts, the community health centers there, they saw a 25% increase in the demand for services for community health center services. So we're thinking we're really ramping up for those services. So we respectfully request that this committee consider an increase to our community health center appropriation from the current $2.3 million. The second point I want to talk about is related to quality measurement. Right now, as we're moving in our healthcare system under payment reform from one that reimburses on fee-for-service basis to values and outcomes, one of the key components of that is quality measurement of outcomes of patients. Right now, as you may all know, 10 FQHCs in the metropolitan area are operating a healthcare demonstration program, and there's some cost sharing if they meet certain financial and quality measures. However, our patients look a little bit different demographically than the statewide averages. Again, 40% don't have insurance, 95% are below 200% of poverty, 70% come from communities of color. It's a very different population from statewide averages. So it is our opinion that comparing our outcomes to statewide averages as currently exist in quality measurement at the Department of Health is not robust enough. So we'd respectfully ask this committee to consider some more investments into the Department of Health to have more risk adjustment methods, and beyond insurance status right now is how it's measured. We want to look at race, ethnicity, housing, poverty, these sorts of measures, these social determinants of health that influence outcomes for our patients. So that is really, we're really striving for an apples-to-apples comparison under quality measurement. We're not running away from our outcomes. We embrace them as community health centers. We just want a more fair level playing field. Those are the two pieces I have today, and I can stand for any questions at this time.
Any questions for Mr. Watson? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Watson. I'm certainly sympathetic to the idea that you serve probably the hardest to serve populations, and the commissioner was here the other day. I'm not sure if you got to hear him talking about how our increasing growth in low-income people and people with other health disparities is really bringing down Minnesota as a state, even in terms of our measures, our quality measures, and our performance. So I'd be really interested in working with you and trying to figure out what is fair assessments, but also, you know, what from your experiences of your clinics can you bring to the broader clinical system about how to help us address health disparities, because, you know, Minnesota does really a good job a lot of times on big measures, and then when you start to look at specific populations of low-income people or people of color, you see a really different story. Mm-hmm. And you know, we literally have people dying early because they're not getting cancer caught early, those other sorts of things, because we're just not as good at reaching out to those populations. And if you feel like you have some insights from your work, not just on the quality end, but also in terms of how we can better address disparities, I think we'd all be interested.
Yeah, Mr. Watson, I would just comment before you answer that, you know, with the white folks in this state, we're usually at close to the top in terms of anything you want to measure in healthcare. And I will say for minority populations, we're sometimes the lowest in the country. You compare our rankings, we don't do a very good job, and that's the population that you have the biggest thing to deal with.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, to answer your question, the one of the statistics that we do well is on low birth rates, actually. We outscore all statewide averages, even for our populations, which is quite impressive. And I think it really boils down to the enabling services that each community health center offers. We offer transportation, language translation services, aggressive outreach, community education forums, those sorts of non-clinical, if you will, is probably a bad term, but those sorts of services that we do provide are a key piece of that. Also, our workforce, we need to have a workforce that's more reflective of the diversity of the state of Minnesota, and that's one of the secrets, quote-unquote secrets, of community health centers is employing providers from the communities that we serve. And just to put a plug in, the third point is the navigator function and the exchange. I know it's not the jurisdiction here today, but again, having community health center staff as navigators and assisting patients as they go through that process is going to be beneficial too moving forward. So I'd be happy to work with you, and I will stop by and chat with you. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Watson.
Thank you.
Next is Carrie Thurlow from Long-Term Care and Toby Pearson. Oh, Toby's not here. Neither is Carrie Thurlow.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Heidi Holstein with Care Providers in Minnesota. Mr. Pearson had a flat tire this morning, so here I am today. So I work for Care Providers in Minnesota, and together, Ms. Christian Knights and I are here representing the Long-Term Care Imperative. We have been working with the Department of Health for several years on proposals related regarding the annual home care the annual home care licensing reform process. We have submitted comments and have had a very productive process with the Department of Health. We did on Friday receive communication from the Department of Health about some of our concerns that we had submitted in the past, and they did address some of our concerns. We're analyzing the information that they sent, but we still feel that we haven't seen the language, the final language yet, so we wanted to make our comments in front of this committee. First, we're concerned about the Department of Health deadlines for transition. Our concern is that current providers will have adequate time to be educated on and incorporate the new regulatory process and language. 12 months is our opinion about what would be necessary for current home care providers to learn the new regulations, revise their policies and procedures, retrain their staff, modify their budgets, and implement new requirements in an organized and systematic manner. Second, we have concerns about the final language on the fines. We will be monitoring this to make sure that they are not too large or fail to tie to specific findings of noncompliance. Finally, the governor does recommend creating a new fee to cover the cost of reviewing blueprints prior to construction or renovation projects involving healthcare facilities. These reviews will ensure that the health and life safety code building standards are met. These fees will be based on the project cost and will allow the department to better recover actual costs incurred. We do have concerns regarding the proposal to create a fee for the review of the blueprints prior to construction. First, we would like clarification about whether the proposed fee would be an allowable cost for nursing homes when they're completing a major addition or a moratorium project. And second, for smaller projects where the state is not providing any reimbursement, the fee is potentially another unfunded mandate. With rates being frozen for the past 4 years, this is problematic for us. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time. My name is Christian Knights, and I'm with Aging Services of Minnesota, representing also the Long-Term Care Imperative. I'm going to touch on another couple of issues just related to the governor's proposal from the Department of Health. The first is the fee increases. There still remains many unanswered questions regarding the license fee and renewal fees. We haven't seen data about how MDH is calculating the projected revenue for this proposal, or about how this will impact each home care provider. We feel this information is vital. While it's important to secure additional resources to support home care surveys, we must also ensure that we avoid unintended consequences, such as forcing home care providers out of business. The second area is in the realm of survey reform. While the governor's proposal takes steps to more fully fund the survey process, we remain concerned that there have been insufficient attention paid to this process itself in full. A home care license fee increase would be significant without significant reform to the survey process itself would not be acceptable. We would like to see some other reforms that would deem critical moving forward. The first would be survey timing to ensure that the new providers are surveyed in the first 12 months of operation and that experienced providers are regularly and consistently surveyed on a more base schedule. The second is better survey training to ensure that the home care surveyors are properly trained in home care best practices and regulation. The third is the targeting survey resources, including a heavier focus on providers and that have a record of or are struggling with some of their performance issues. And finally, to establish an appeals process, giving the ability to appeal survey findings to a neutral entity. Right now, it's kind of one against one, somewhat one person's word against the other. We would like to see a neutral entity brought into that. We have shared, as Heidi mentioned, we've shared the long-term care imperative to share these suggested reforms with the department in December, and we look forward to continue the conversations about these ideas and progress in the reform process moving forward. So, thank you.
Questions? I don't see any, so... Oh, wait a minute, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Holstein, in terms of the blueprint review, you said it was really going to be focused on life safety issues, and I assume that that's because there's been some problems with architects not necessarily thinking about the unique needs of this population. But I have been struck in visiting some facilities that were designed for people who are elderly, frail, and or likely moving in because of health issues, at how it's not just the design of the building, but sometimes the furnishings and things just don't seem to really recognize who's going to be living there. I mean, I've sat in overstuffed chairs and I have a hard time at 5 feet two getting out of, let alone someone who has arthritis and other issues. And, you know, I'm just, you know, I know some of these are being established by companies that were more in the apartment business rather than who came out of a history of in the industry of serving people who are elderly. And so I think that kind of reflects some naivety about just even understanding their populations as they try to get into a new business line. And, you know, is there anyone who's working or consulting with people on that? Because they're investing tons of money into furnishings that I know are sometimes more attractive and designed to attract the children of the residents than maybe the serve the needs of the residents who are going to be there 7 days a week. And is anyone addressing that in any way?
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, to your first point about the life safety code, it's my understanding that the department is looking simply for a way to recover the costs of what is already occurring. I don't believe that there are any actual changes to the life safety code itself. Secondly, on the furnishings, I just want to share an anecdote with you. I was in Little Falls speaking to a group of housing providers, and the owner of the company was there, and she's a nurse. And they were on their way actually to Wisconsin to do some shopping to set up their new facility or their new place that they were opening. And I would expect that, you know, she has a number of these settings and is very familiar with the needs of what the people who are living there have. With that said, however, I understand your concern. There are a number of consulting companies out there that our members work with. I can't tell you for certain that they all work with consulting companies, but our expectation is that they would all have the needs of the people living in the setting to the top of mind at all times. As you know, they try to make these places look as home-like as possible because these are these people's home. But you know, it's something that we can also remind our memberships about, that there are furnishings and appropriate things that you should be placing and inappropriate things that you should be placing in these settings.
Thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you. And I know most places do a really good job, but I do think there, I mean, I can just name, and I won't, into the record, but a number of entities that really are in the provision of rental services, and I think those are the ones that least understand maybe the population. They're going to step up, and there's clearly a need for some education.
Sure, and Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, I'll also put a plug in for a bill that we're bringing forward that has some best practices in housing with services settings, and one of those best practices we feel is training for housing managers. 30 hours of training every 2 years is what we're asking for, and so perhaps that can be something that's addressed in those training sessions as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I don't see any, so thank you for your testimony. Next is Matt Schaefer from the American Cancer Society.
What?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Rachel Callanan. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Matt Schaefer. I am the State Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm sure as this committee is aware, we're spending a lot of money nationwide on health care expenses. I think right now we're looking at about 16% of our GDP, and unfortunately that number is continuing to go up. And while this committee already has debated and will continue to debate to discuss a number of different initiatives that will look at expanding access to coverage for more Minnesotans, an effort that we both of our organizations support, I think it's worth mentioning that if we're ever really going to get our arms around cost containment and becoming a healthier Minnesota, we really need to make a meaningful commitment to an investment in public health. And from our standpoint, the governor's budget is a big step in the right direction. While it's not directly in the MDH budget, I do want to thank the governor for including an increase in the price of tobacco products. 77,000 kids are going to try tobacco for the first time this year, and most of them will end up addicted. Most of them will set themselves up for a lifetime of disease and possibly premature death. One-third of every cancer diagnosis in our country is tobacco-related. So we appreciate raising the price of tobacco products as the most effective means of influencing one's decision to quit smoking or never take up the habit altogether. And so we're very appreciative that's in the budget, and that is going to make a meaningful commitment. Additionally, we appreciate the governor including funding for the SAGE breast and cervical cancer screening program. I know we're looking at expanding access, but in talks we've had with Department of Health as well as the CDC at the national level, it's important that as we get a better understanding of what our uninsured and underinsured population look like, there's aspects of the safety net that really need to stay intact. And with the SAGE program, I always just like telling a story. A couple years ago, I was at a Relay for Life, and we ran into Brenda. She was wearing a purple shirt, which means she was a survivor. And on Thursday, she went in for a medical appointment. On Friday, she found out that she was laid off. And this was right around the end of 08, so it was right in the middle of a pretty bad recession. She got a call from her physician shortly thereafter saying, you need to come back in. We need to do some more tests. And her immediate response was, well, I don't have a job. I'm not real sure what my insurance situation is, so we're trying to figure out the logistics. And her provider said, I don't think you understood me. You need to come in for an exam. Turned out she had breast cancer. That screening was paid for under the SAGE program. Her provider worked with her to figure out her insurance situation, and she was able to undergo cancer treatment. And today she got her job back. She's insured in the private market. She's a taxpayer, and she's a survivor. And she'll continue to be working for many years to come from what I can understand. She's also a very passionate advocate for our organization, so we're happy with that. I'd also like to speak, and also we appreciate the governor's investment in the SHIP program for many of the same reasons that Representative Norton articulated yesterday. My colleague Rachel Callanan from the American Heart Association will go into more depth, but I wanted to provide you with an analogy. I recently heard Dr. Donald Warren, who's the Director of Public Health with North Dakota State University, offered, and that's that equality is the art of giving people a pair of shoes, but equity is the art of giving people shoes that fit. And one of the reasons why we like SHIP is because this is a program that provides grants to local communities, but then they work with the department and give them the latitude to implement policies that make sense for them. So it's not a top-down approach. It's giving your community a chance to say, this is what's really going to work well for Rochester. This is really going to be what works well for Duluth. It's not somebody from Atlanta or St. Paul making that decision for you. So we appreciate the governor including that funding, and we do hope that that remains in your budget as well, Mr. Chair. I mean, at the end of the day, it's not enough for our organizations to say we need to eat healthier food and our kids need to eat healthier lunches. We have to make sure that our kids are getting healthier lunches at school, and that's one thing the SHIP does. It's not enough to tell our kids they need to work out more and they need to go out and ride their bikes. So there needs to be a commitment to making sure there are safe trails, safe parks, safe routes to school, and that's something else that SHIP works on. So to close, should this legislature choose to raise the price of tobacco products, preserve our state's safety net, and invest in public health, and your successors choose to do the same, I should caution you that you will be well on your way to killing at least two jobs, our jobs, and we want to help.
Ms. Callanan.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rachel Callanan, and I'm Regional Vice President of Advocacy for the American Heart Association. Thank you for hearing testimony today on the governor's budget. I'm here to focus on preventing heart disease and stroke in Minnesota, and the governor's budget goes a long way to achieve that goal. Two of the greatest preventable risk factors for heart disease and stroke are tobacco use and overweight or obesity. I echo my colleagues' comments about the tobacco tax and the governor's budget. No single thing you do this year could touch as many and save as many, touch as many people and save as many lives as that one single policy. Increasing the price of tobacco is truly the most impactful policy you could pass to ensure that children never join a lifetime of tobacco addiction. But I want to focus on another key component of the governor's budget. In 2008, there was a bipartisan and visionary effort to tackle these two risk factors. When the statewide health improvement program was created, its selling points were that it would touch every county in the state. It was based on evidence of what is an effect, what are effective strategies. In other words, of the menu of activities that a community could embark on, they were all based in research that showed reduction in tobacco use or an increase to healthier eating and physical activity. It was driven by the local community's priorities. A community leadership team was formed to identify the priorities for those specific communities and to lead the charge and to begin making those changes. And it promised to begin reducing healthcare costs over time by keeping people healthy longer. The program has been underway for 4 years, originally funded at $47 million for the biennium, but was cut back the last biennium by over two-thirds. We applaud Governor Dayton for breathing life back into the program in his budget with significant and sustained funding. I wanted to share a few examples of what this investment is doing around the state. I was privileged to attend a number of healthy community forums around the state this fall and winter. Hundreds of people literally turned out to these different community forums to learn about SHIP and the healthy living activities taking place in their community. I was amazed at the work that is being done and the impact that is being felt in those communities with the grants. What I discovered is that the small investment of SHIP, no matter what the strategy was, acted as a catalyst in each community. SHIP was the seed planted to create a two-acre school garden at Sibley East High School in Arlington, Minnesota, which is in south-central Minnesota. Mitchell Wensleff was a junior who presented at this community health forum, did a fabulous job, and he explained how he and other students grew over 700 pounds of tomatoes for use in their school cafeteria. They made salsa, they froze the tomatoes, and are still, we actually had them at in the Capitol Rotunda yesterday with a display table. I think some of you were able to stop by and visit with them. Just amazing ability to create this momentum. And what they told me yesterday is that that program is now sustainable because they are selling shares, community CSA shares, so members of the community are buying shares of their garden. They're able to spread the produce out, and then also just within the school, they're able to reduce some of their costs in the school because the kids are growing this food. Very exciting. Another example is the Little Huskies Daycare in Jackson, Minnesota, where Amanda Benda was able to launch a healthy eating and active child care program at her daycare. SHIP was the impetus to get it off the ground in the first round of grants 2 years ago, but the program has sustained and has impacted the lives of 82 children. A SHIP grant in St. Cloud built the momentum behind a tremendous grassroots effort to examine, then enact a smoke-free campus at St. Cloud State. And these are just a few of the hundreds of examples of how SHIP has had a lasting impact on communities and, more importantly, has helped to make the healthy choice the easy choice. I thank you for your time today. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for the two? I don't see any, so thank you for your testimony, and I'm sorry I missed the tomatoes.
We can bring them in and testify.
Sam Walseth, Sustainable Resource Center. Welcome to the committee, and would you, when you start your testimony, state your name for the tape.
Mr. Chairman and members, I'm Sam Walseth, lobbyist for the Sustainable Resources Center. SRC is a Minneapolis-based nonprofit organization dedicated to advancing the cause of healthy homes. SRC's mission is to create healthy and efficient home environments in partnership with families and communities. SRC's programs include weatherization, lead hazard reduction, education control, healthy home solutions, and trainings. I'm here today to express SRC's support for several provisions of the governor's Department of Health proposal. Concern over one item and to urge you to explore strategies for advancing a healthy homes agenda in Minnesota. For starters, Minnesota has a public health success story to tell. That story is one of preventing thousands of children from suffering permanent brain damage due to childhood lead poisoning. Minnesota has a track record of success in reducing the number of children under the age of six diagnosed with elevated blood lead levels. The 2001 Minnesota Department of Health lead surveillance report shows that while the number of children tested for elevated blood lead levels rose from 35,000 in 1995 to 93,000 in 2011, the number of EBLs dropped from 4,300 down to 584 over that same period. Mr. Chairman, members, I did bring just one copy of the chart from that report. In an effort to save paper, I just hand out one, and you could pass it around and take a look. It's a pretty impressive chart from the last surveillance report. This public health success story can be attributed to Minnesota's attention to the issue at the state and local level, with leadership from the legislature to the Minnesota Department of Health through investments in lead poisoning surveillance, lead education prevention grants, and a requirement by DHS to hold health plans accountable for testing children. Unfortunately, I'm here today to let you know that this strong partnership has been compromised, as you heard about from Dr. Ellinger, Commissioner Ellinger, yesterday. A year ago, Minnesota received unfortunate news that the CDC was eliminating lead prevention funds that support our Minnesota Department of Health's lead surveillance capacity. The irony of this move is that it came at the same time the CDC announced that there is no safe level of lead in a child's body and actually lowered the regulatory threshold from 10 micrograms of lead per deciliter of blood down to 5. In fact, Mr. Chairman and members, in 2011, over 3,300 children in Minnesota were tested above 5. That compares to our current regulatory threshold of 10, where you have the 584. Clearly, the need for lead poisoning prevention efforts is still very much in need. To meet this goal, the governor's plan includes at least $100,000 to backfill a portion of lost CDC funds for our lead surveillance system. The lead surveillance system has been operated by MDH since 1995. This system tells us how many children are tested, how many have been exposed to lead, what the lead levels are, and in which neighborhoods have the highest exposure levels. It makes it possible for health plans to identify those children at risk who do not have been screened and to make special efforts to get to them. We support the governor's request for these funds. However, we're a little concerned that the department does need additional funding, and as Ms. Reed from the department testified yesterday, they're exploring other strategies to backfill those dollars. Our concern would be that those dollars might end up coming from the lead prevention grants that the state has funded for a number of years that are currently at an amount of $485,000 per year. For instance, another $100,000 transfer from that fund, from those grants to backfill surveillance funds would represent a 21% reduction in prevention grants available to the public. And Mr. Chairman, I do want to thank Representative Abler for his work in the last budget cycle for preserving 100% of those grant funds in a very, very difficult budget cycle. It's important for me to note that the prevention grants have been used to leverage millions of dollars in HUD lead control grants over the years. We've used those prevention grants to match as a local match to draw down a lot of HUD money. Together, those funds last year alone supported lead inspections in 222 homes, removal of lead hazards in 132 homes, hundreds of educational and outreach events across the state that reached thousands of children and their families. These dollars supported training hundreds of workers and homeowners in lead-safe work practices and hundreds of home visits to families whose children tested positive for an elevated blood lead level. When we know there's no safe level of lead in our children, it's not time to be cutting back in education, outreach, and primary prevention. Not that anyone's specifically proposing that today. Once the brain damage is done, it's too late for that child. Minnesota must continue the strong public health success story, which has saved many a child's future and countless taxpayer dollars in preventable health care and special education costs. Mr. Chairman, with that, I'll close my comments and answer questions.
Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for, I forgot that we talked about those last year. I'm glad we could. And my question is kind of about that. In the past, I've also carried, and other members have carried, the lead abatement grants. I'm pleased that we're down to, I looked at your chart, it looks like about 0.5% of the kids tested have an issue, which is better than it was. But those kids, as Mr. Walseth mentioned, those lead in your brain just doesn't do anything to help make anything go better, and it's permanent, and it just ruins the opportunities they have to ever become anything of what their genes would have provided for them. So, Mr. Walseth, can you just tell me the how that lead abatement thing is going? And you know, I know the money is not infinite ever, and we didn't discuss adding money last year. We were just trying to preserve things, or 2 years ago. But if you added money, how much money would be useful to add back, and what kind of effects could you expect, and also the status of the lead abatement monies that we do?
You know, Mr. Chairman, Representative Ayler, I haven't talked to my client about what we could do with additional funds. We've just been asking for the last several budget cycles to maintain the funding level that has been there. The prevention grants were once at a high point of $500,000. The legislature has essentially maintained that level, although there have been in each budget cycle there have been about like a 2 or 3% cut to Department of Health prevention grants, and so that's kind of whittled it down. I think it's at a $485,000 level per year today. With those dollars, what is conducted? Those grant dollars have gone out to two organizations, the one I'm representing today, and then another group called ClearCorps Minnesota, which stands for Community Lead Education Reduction Corps. Those two organizations together conduct. I've got a few numbers here for you. Grant activities from 2012. They conducted 191 metro area education events, 15 events in Greater Minnesota. They had almost 5,000 educational touches where they actually talked directly to two families. With those dollars, they were able to test 1,700 kids. Lead safe work practice trainings. They held 28 training sessions. Where 356 people received lead-safe work training. They did 481 home visits and cleaned up 132 homes. So a significant amount of work and prevention and outreach work that's done with those dollars. You know, if you added, obviously organizations love to see new money, but, you know, what we're asking for is to maintain, you know, have the state maintain that current effort. I could get back to you, Representative Abler, with what we might be able to do with additional dollars should that be on the table.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Abler.
And I'm not trying to be a big spender here, but there are some things that if you spend more on, you get twice the benefit. Like you fix twice as many houses, twice as many kids aren't exposed, and it's a direct correlation. But do you know how many houses are left in Minnesota that have the old lead paint that you're removing? And
Mr. Chair, I don't think, and Representative Abler, I don't think there's been an exhaustive survey, but basically lead in paint was primarily used from the 40s, 50s, and 60s. It was officially banned by federal law in 1978. So older housing stock, primarily in urban core, is where you're going to find lead sources. In your newer suburban communities where the housing stock's built, you know, after the 70s, you're not going to find it there. You know, I live in an old house in St. Paul. It was built in 1906. I haven't done the test yet, but I've got a five-month-old baby, and, yeah, I'm going to figure out where the lead is in my house and take care of it. So it's that older housing stock is where you're going to find it.
And Mr. Chair, and I don't want to talk all day about this, but it's having carried the bill and worked with the other group, mm-hmm. with the same person, it's just something that's really important, you know, and we talk about prevention. And so part of it's not removing it, it's just keeping it contained and, you know, they don't eat it and all that. So anyway, I'm just glad we can call attention to it a little bit. I know that sometimes the dirt in some of the neighborhoods has had to be removed, and it might be productive just as you do your planning for next year's work and with your organization to decide how big the scope of the problem is and what dirt still has to be removed in what neighborhoods. Some neighborhoods are especially vulnerable, and they're the most economically challenged areas anyway sometimes. There's less means that the family has to even do it. They maybe aren't even aware of it, so... Anyway, thanks for attention, Mr. Chair.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to our witness. I'm wondering how much the lead coalitions and the agencies that are working on this are really working in partnership with public health on the hand-washing issue, because, I mean, there's millions of homes in all parts of the state that were built pre-1978. I suspect it's the vast majority of housing in Minnesota. And yet we know that in addition to, you know, making sure there isn't loose paint and, you know, kids aren't exposed and, you know, you have the soil thing, the number one prevention is, you know, effective hand washing. And I'm just concerned about, I hear more and more from parents who have kids in school systems that are using the hand sanitizers, and which, you know, might kill bacteria, but I don't think they're going to do anything with the lead that the kid might have picked up in the playground or in other and other exposures. And I'm just wondering if we have an effective effort going on that end as well, because kids just don't seem to have the concept that, or families even, that, you know, like you see them in fast foods or whatever, they don't think, oh, we should go in and wash our hands before we have our meal, or, you know, that sort of thing. And yet, you know, hand washing before snacks for a lot of people who are living in circumstances where there's exposure would really help.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Loeffler. As I mentioned, with the prevention grants, those educational events are a key component what those prevention grants go toward, and that is talking with the families about how to keep the home clean, look for chipping and peeling paint, and cleaning up dust and washing hands and doing some of the basics to prevent lead exposure.
Okay. Any other questions? I don't see any. Wait a minute, Representative Moran. I was going to say I have a house that's 1920. Yeah, it's been repainted many times to keep that stuff.
Keep it encapsulated, and it's not a problem.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to wait until the last presenter presented, but sometimes I always forget and don't have run out of time if something happens. So I said I better get this in now. But I just really want to thank the presenters for coming in today and talk about the work that they're doing. And more importantly, I think I'm really excited that the governor and this legislature is working towards looking, when we budget, how we do that in a smart way. And a part of doing it in a smart way is looking at prevention, because we know if we work at that front end, we save so much money in the back end. So I just needed to say that, you know, I think that we are going in a good direction.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony, and we'll move on.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We have two people from Hennepin County, Michael Harristhal, who I don't see, and Deborah Anderson.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is David Godfrey. I'm representing Hennepin County Medical Center today in place of Michael Harristhal. And with me is Deborah Anderson, the director of the Regional Poison Control Center at HCMC. We thank you for this opportunity to testify on the governor's proposed budget for the Department of Health. Some of you may be familiar with HCMC, very familiar if you're from Hennepin County. Some of you may not be as familiar. We are proud of our programs at HCMC, which is a vital statewide resource renowned for our safety net mission to ensure access for all. Our services include the largest and longest standing level one trauma center and emergency services department, and the largest emergency department in the state. In addition to our hospital, we have developed a clinic system that serves over 500,000 provides over 500,000 outpatient encounters each year. Our services include medicine, surgery, obstetrics, pediatrics, psychiatry, and dentistry. We are the largest single provider of care in Minnesota for Medicaid enrollees. Typically, we provide up to 20% of all Medicaid hospital services across the state. In addition, we are one of the largest providers of clinical training for education of physicians and healthcare professionals, and an integral component in the preparation for and provisions of services for emergency and disaster preparedness, such as we did in the I-35W bridge collapse incident. We are dedicated to ensuring that Minnesotans get the best value for their dollar in healthcare spending. Among our innovations have included the adoption of healthcare homes, participation in the Coordinated Care Delivery System initiative in 2010, and our Hennepin Health ACO-like pilot program that was launched in 2012. We take pride in the fact that we've been able to keep the rate of our cost increases at HCMC for the last several years lower than that of healthcare inflation. There are many aspects of the governor's budget proposal that we like: MA expansion, the rate increase for hospitals, and restoration of the funding for the Merck program. We have two areas of concern, however. One is the provision relative to the 340B pricing for pharmaceuticals, which we spoke to this committee about on February 7th. With that, that item represents the equivalent of a 32% rate cut for our outpatient pharmacy services. A second area of concern we believe should be addressed in the governor's budget, in particular in the Department of Health budget, is funding for the Poison Control Center. As there's been intense pressure on public health care program costs, we struggle to break even from our operations each year. Typically, our margin at HCMC is just a fraction above zero. We believe that additional and as funding from other sources is diminished, we are unable to cross-subsidize other certain programs that have statewide benefit, like the Poison Control Center. So with that, I'll hand it over to Ms. Anderson, and she'll speak more directly to the issues around the Poison Control Center.
If I could just comment before, we are going to have a separate hearing on the 340B problem, so at least the legislators will be able to understand what the problem is and what we can do about it.
Great. Mr. Chair, that's excellent news, and we'll be happy to participate in any way we can.
Ms. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Debbie Anderson. I'm the director of the Minnesota Poison Control System, which is located at HCMC. The Poison Center is one of the programs that putting a little bit of money up front saves a lot of money in the end. So the Poison Center's purpose is to provide immediate medical access and treatment recommendations to poisoning. And it's a broad array of poisonings that we're talking about. It includes prescription drug abuse, which is a real common issue right now. The synthetics, we do provide medical management for some lead poisoning cases as well. This service is provided statewide for both public callers and healthcare callers. In 2012, over 54,000 calls from throughout the state were managed by our highly specialized staff of experts at HCMC. In addition to the standby capacity available to all, the Poison Center is one of the most valuable resources we have when it comes to illness and injury prevention and the public's health. It is well documented that every dollar spent on Poison Center services avoids an estimated $11 in unnecessary medical spending, saving Minnesotans over $26 million this past year. 92% of poisoning exposures that start in the home when the public calls us are managed in the home. And this prevents unnecessary health care visits as well as overcrowding of the emergency departments. The Poison Center also provides critical public health surveillance, emergency planning, and response services, in addition to public prevention and professional education. The Hennepin County Medical Center last year provided $800,000 to supplement this statewide program, and that was to supplement state and federal funding. Given tightening reimbursement rates and economic pressure, HCMC is no longer able to subsidize the program. We believe that a dedicated and durable funding source is needed to ensure immediate and cost-effective services for all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Questions? I'll just have a comment that various hospitals are not the same, and Hennepin County has the Poison Center, which is a statewide program. They also have the hyperbaric facility that's the only one in the state, I believe. And I would also, not to get away from Hennepin County Hospital, but Regions has a burn center that they bring people to Regions from North Dakota, because there's nothing in between North Dakota and Regions Hospital that can really deal with the severe burns. So some of these hospitals have much different, or not much different, but certain programs that have statewide, in fact, regional impacts. And if they lose money on them, that's a problem for the whole state.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, the Poison Center is mandated by state statute, and we are really a vendor for the service. Minnesota Department of Health is charged with operating that program. So, just to make you aware. But it's been at HCMC for a very long time.
Thank you. Any questions? I don't see any, so thank you for your testimony. And we're actually going to finish early today, which is a record. Oh, Representative McDonald, you have only 20 minutes.
I only need 19, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chair. See, I thought maybe perhaps, as the Chair, you could run through, you know, you and I talked earlier before the meeting, the next bill will be coming through this committee, and I was wondering if you could run through some of the meeting scheduled dates for us.
Okay. This relates to the exchange hearing we're going to have in this committee, and we're going to meet Thursday at the regular time to discuss the exchange. We will meet Thursday in the evening, and the more controversial one, according to Representative McDonald, and I sort of agree, is Friday morning. We'll continue testimony, and we will be able to ask questions of various staff and so on. And then but there will be no voting until Monday morning. And so we're not going to have a lot of time Monday morning, but hopefully a lot of the questions will be asked in the first three meetings, so we can get on to voting on Monday. My
wife is not. Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative McDonald.
Of course, my opinion doesn't matter to a hill of beans, but I must say, and I mentioned to that earlier, but for the record, my friend Grunhagen insulting me in public like this, is that I share with you that it is disappointing that the biggest bill that I'll probably ever see and the biggest change to the state of Minnesota in our health care is coming to us on non-committee scheduled days. That happens in the legislature. I recognize that. I know that happens. We're still only less than around 30 days into the legislature, or the session, so we do have some time. But to bring it forth, we all have, business other than the legislature on Fridays and Mondays are normal scheduled events, so it's disappointing that it's coming to those days and some of us that aren't able to make it, perhaps, when I really was hoping it would be scheduled for our committee days, the scheduled days, and I know you and I shared with that. It is disappointing, but some things can't be done, but I'm compelled to express my opinion on that. I cannot be here Friday, unfortunately, and I want to be here for that, but I have other commitments that certainly circumvent that, and or supersede that, rather, so. And you and I shared that earlier.
Well, I agree with you, Representative McDonald. One of the problems we have with this particular bill that it has to be done. And we have, we're going to have a conference committee. Who knows how long it's going to last. It probably has a couple more committees that it has to go to. Yeah, and we have to pass it probably by the 20th. Of March to meet the federal deadline, so it is, and I agree with you, it's a very important issue and it's very complex, but with the federal timelines we got to rush through.
If I may, Mr. Chair, the federal government, I know they also extended the timelines, didn't they? They're not able to reach their timelines, so therefore they extended it, but that doesn't that doesn't help us at all, does it?
My understanding, and somebody can correct me, that the original timeline was February, and they moved it back a month into March. But one of the problems we have is we're also going to be the last week of March. We'll be on Easter break, so we've got to get it passed before that, signed by the governor. Mm-hmm. And Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I just wanted to comment, first of all, to say again that the reason we're in this position is because basically nothing was done over the last couple of years, and the Republican majorities basically could have had any bill they wanted and had a couple of years to pass something and didn't. So that's why we're in this situation. So I think that needs to be stated. The other thing is I just find it kind of ironic that when the bill was in my committee, the complaint was that we didn't have enough time. And granted, our scheduling is such that we only have so many hours of pre-scheduled committee time that are assigned to us. But here, what I see Representative Huntley doing is trying to remedy that problem and not have the same complaint. And many of the members, I know there's not complete overlap, but people complained bitterly that there was not enough time to question witnesses. So Representative Huntley is providing that time here. Now, I understand people have different things scheduled on Friday and Monday. I do, too. I don't usually get here Monday morning. But if people, you can't have it both ways. I guess that's my message, Representative McDonald, and I'm not saying you in particular are arguing on both sides, but if the minority wants to ask a lot of questions and really have them answered and so on, the first thing that you're, you can have other things scheduled, but here during session, committee time is first priority time. So while we all have those issues with multiple scheduled things, it's kind of, this is the big thing. And the other, my final point is this idea that this is the biggest change in 50 years. I don't know if that's true for the insurance exchange piece of this, frankly. I don't know if that's really true. I don't know where that phrase is coming from. But Representative Huntley is doing his best to provide plenty of time for all the discussion that you guys want. And I just want to say again that the minority really can't have it both ways. If you want to ask the questions and make the comments, and I think you absolutely should, this is how we've got to do it.
Representative Abler.
Thanks. And Representative, Mr. Chair, and Representative Liebling, just, you know, that 50-year thing came from the chair of the committee here, so.
Well, let me respond to that.
That wasn't my main point.
If you look at the Affordable Care Law, the whole package is, I think, the biggest change since 65 when we passed Medicare and medical assistance. The exchange is just a part of the Affordable Care Law, but it is a very important part, and it is, I will certainly agree that it's very complex, and hardly anybody here understands every colon and semicolon that's in that in that bill. So it is a complex issue, and it's a very important part of the Affordable Care Act, and we should have time for lots of questions and answers. But thank Representative Abler, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I understand the dilemma that Representative McDonald brings forward, and actually I agree with the bulk of the comments by Representative Liebling. I saw it as a generous way to create dialogue. I'm not going to be here on Friday. I have to do my day job, and just because I can't be here doesn't mean you didn't try to have time available, and hopefully the members that want to have deep questions can come that day and get their questions answered. It could be a short meeting, and maybe we'll get done on. So I just want to get the schedule clear. But I saw it as an effort, and it's hard running the committee. I was very critical of all my finance chairs before I became a finance chair. Like, any idiot can do this thing. I realized that this idiot struggled to do things, and I argued about process, and then myself engineered one of the uglier processes I'd ever been through last 2 years, and Representative Liebling was correct to point that out to me on more than one occasion, as I recall. And she was right. But anyway, so we try, you know, and but I see it as a good faith effort to create the dialogue, and with the notice that's there, I think for my side of the aisle, if you have questions and you want to interrogate the Take Action folks or the health plans or whomever, I think that is the opportunity to do that. Just a question about the schedule. So it's the Thursday meeting time and then Thursday after session. Mm-hmm. And is there a time, just a half hour after session or something? Or do you have an idea how long?
It would probably be 30 minutes.
Yeah. 30 minutes, and then that hopefully it'll be a reasonably, won't be at 2:30 in the morning session. It'd be hard to discuss this at 3 in the morning, Mr. Chair. but so, and then we'll go for a period of hours then, do you think, that until we kind of get done? Or okay. And is that kind of open? I'm not talking about filibusters, but just is it, and so maybe we'll get done on Thursday night and have satisfied our desire to chat, and then there wouldn't be a Friday meeting, potentially.
That would be true. And I will say, in my life, my number one priority is my wife's health, and my number two priority is my health. And we, on Friday afternoon, my wife has her annual physical in Duluth in the afternoon, and I have my annual meeting with my primary care doc, so we won't be running overtime Friday morning if we meet Friday morning.
Right. And so just as a logistical thing, perhaps we could just, you know, and I've urged, I can't call anybody what they say, but I've encouraged people, I'll encourage everybody just to kind of focus on the bill and the topic. And, you know, we've discussed the ACA / Obamacare at some length, and we'll discuss it more yet. But that's here, and the Supreme Court has ruled, and now we have this matter before us. Shall we or shall we not have a state exchange? That's the question before us. If we have one, what's it look like? And so I think as we query our witnesses on that, that will help us get done. And so I really appreciate the time you're offering. And then a question about Monday morning, 9 o'clock till noon, which could be ample time. But logistically, do you plan, it can't be moved on the floor yet by Monday because their committee report wouldn't be done. And when is it going to move on the floor? On Tuesday then? Will there be a short session to move it? Is it going to taxes?
It's going to taxes.
And so the hope would be to move it on Tuesday, probably in a short.
If they have a short session, yeah. We could then send it to taxes.
Yeah, and that's not set for sure yet.
No.
All right. And so I will urge whatever influence I have to not filibuster amendments. But if there's dialogue, and I plan to bring a number of amendments, Mr. Chair, that are meant to be functional, and I plan to be pointed and brief with my amendments, and the author will take them or not. And I hopefully that seems like a lot of time. So if it's enough time, but I just leave it open that if you judge that there's been sincere dialogue and people aren't just dragging it out, that, and knowing it doesn't have to move on the floor, that perhaps we could have some time Monday later if we need it. And I'll just bring that as a suggestion to you, and you're the chair. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Grunhagen.
As long as Representative McDonald and Abler aren't going to be here on Friday, do you mind if I take their allocated time to comment on that? I've only said about 10% of what I want to say, okay?
Any other questions? So we are getting done early, so this meeting is adjourned.